You're listening to Conversations on Strategy, a U.S. Army War College Press production focused on national security affairs. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. Joining me today are Colonel Richard D. Butler, Josh Rostegi, and Dr. Luke P. Balaki. Butler's the director of the China Land Power Study Center at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. Rostegi is the academic chair and research director at the China Land Power Study Center at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. Balaki is the author of The Strategic Importance of Taiwan to the United States and its Allies, Parts 1 and 2, published in the summer and autumn 2023 issues of Parameters. He's held senior and senior executive positions through his government career and is now an associate professor of practice at the National Defense University. Welcome to Conversations on Strategy. Do you believe the application of strategic land power in the Indo-PACOM area of responsibility can help the U.S. and its allies enhance the survivability of Taiwan in light of the PRC threat?
Hi, this is Rich Butler. First of all, if you look at how the PLA view themselves, they come from a ground-oriented background. All their major conflicts have been launched and held mostly in the ground terrain. So how they think and make decisions and how they do operational art or their version of it certainly plays out of the way that the PLA Army fights. In fact, the way they're transitioning their theaters of operation, primarily ground-led, and if you look specifically at how they're building their fleet and their Air Force to link into their Army and their Marine Corps and their special operators, including their Airborne Corps, which is under the Air Force, is all meant to achieve that 27 objective that Xi put out that the military will be ready. I think there's an awful lot of ways that we can study both the PLA, its Army, and how it ties to its joint force. And if you flip that over to our side, the Army in the Indo-Pacific, the Marines in the Indo-Pacific, the special operators on the U.S. side working hand-in-hand with our allies, which are generally Army-oriented cultures in their militaries, because the first thing you build when you have to defend yourself is an Army. It's less expensive than modern navies and modern air forces. And we get a lot of buy-in when those elements of our strategic land power go in, start working to make sure that everybody's on the same team as we work about the free Indo-Pacific and implementing that national strategy. The other thing that's important is it provides options. If you look at the way the Marines and the Army are starting to shift to the Marine Littoral Regiments, the multi-domain task forces, and bringing in the capabilities, both kinetic and non-kinetic, that can get after threats in the maritime and air domain, increase our magazine depth, break down C2 networks, and allow more trade space and time for the joint force to provide options to the president, the secretary, and the governments of our allies and strategic partners. I think that's all critically important, understanding that as we go forward.
This is Luke Balaki. Completely agree with Rich. I think the mentality of the Chinese military is very much land-based. And if you look at their modern history of China and since the PRC's founding, their conflicts in Korea and invasion of North Vietnam, it's very much overwhelming troop force, throw as many bodies as you can. I think when it comes to Taiwan, I can speculate their mentalities. In addition to using modern warfare, they're probably going to use every boat they can find. There's some 300,000 plus fishing boats in the South China Sea alone every day. I would surmise that they probably will use every floating craft they have and put as many troops as they can to effectuate an amphibious landing however they can. That's all speculation, of course, but the other big threat is whether they would go for just simply blockading Taiwan, and there are a lot of implications for that as well.
Hi, this is Josh Rostegi. The application of strategic land power is a big focus for us, especially within the Indo-PACOM AOR here at the China Land Power Study Center. And I believe it's really important for us to understand how the Chinese will apply strategic land power. I think there's a lot of organizations that do a good job looking at the tactical implications of Chinese ground forces and other military forces. But for us, understanding intent, operations, and strategy, that's a big deal. But understanding that more in depth will also give Taiwan a better capacity to defend itself if that becomes the case. But also understanding Taiwan's own capability to apply strategic land power within its own borders is something that we really need to focus research on. That way, it helps provide both U.S. policymakers and allies a better understanding of how we should get more involved with Taiwan.
I'll just add, we were just talking a little bit about Operation Causeway, which is the recently declassified plans for the U.S. to invade Taiwan, stemming back from the 50s or so, and does show some interesting land power issues, such as the very rocky terrain of Taiwan really only allows for a couple of areas to reasonably establish a beachhead anywhere. Right now, also places like Taipei, New Taipei City, are heavily populated. If China ever tried to assault those areas, gain access to those ports, it would be very difficult urban fighting terrain. It kind of reminds me of the Gaza situation that Israel's going through right now, and they have a lot to learn from that aspect as well.
In light of the ongoing conflicts in Ukraine and Gaza, if China was to initiate some kind of conflict on Taiwan or a blockade, recently the DNI said that this could cost the global market close to $1 trillion or more. What are your opinions on this?
It was her testimony for congressional committee that it would cost the world economy over $1 trillion a year. People talk about the critical importance of semiconductors coming out of Taiwan. They aren't just regular old semiconductors. They are the most sophisticated semiconductors that are being produced in the world now. Moreover, we saw during COVID that even a small disruption in the supply chain for something as critical as semiconductors or other material that coming from Taiwan or having to go around Taiwan to avoid any kind of conflict or blockade just shuts down the whole supply chain for things like just automobiles. And they use hundreds of semiconductors, chips, and other parts. And the world economy really is very tightly wound around the world supply chain. No business wants to have a backup or delay or have to pay for inventory even just to wait for other parts so that they can put them together somewhere. Everything is perfectly timed so that there aren't any inventory costs and backup costs. The head of Maersk, one of the largest shipping line companies in the world, also said it would be extremely expensive just to even delay for a few days because ships would have to go around Taiwan, let's say. George Mason University had a study that showed the Ukraine conflict has caused supply chain issues that cost even insurance for shipping somewhere upwards of about 1% a day increase, which means, let's say, a week or 2 weeks would be around 14% more cost just in transportation, not even counting all the backup and inventory costs that businesses would have to incur.
Yeah, I think that's some important points there about what is the deterrent effect that we have. From the military perspective, you begin with a lot of what we're doing and what we've done over the last several years as we worked harder with allies and partners to up the military deterrence threshold inside the first island chain so that they understand there's no easy fight that they can win quickly, they being Xi and the CCP, particularly the senior leadership around him. And that's important because if you do it right and you maintain that deterrent value correctly over time, you're actually allowing things that we're really good at in the Western-oriented, free market, democratic world catch up. You let our economies work together and you begin to catch up and you build resiliency and you build your diplomatic ways of doing business so that Taiwan has additional resilience aside from its own military strength because it's already a strong market, free economy, democratically elected government. This is all important as to what in the U.S. side we're calling integrated deterrence, but really it harkens back to maintaining the resiliency of the free world, which we started doing in the middle of the 19th century, especially as we began to close the American West and start moving out into the Indo-Pacific as an economic power and then a military power. So these all tie together, beginning with the stance from the military perspective, what type of conflict would you expect? And if Xi believes that it's not going to be a short, sharp war, which I think clearly Ukraine and Gaza prove out, and especially in the historic terms, when peer adversaries break the deterrence threshold and they go to conflict, they're generally not short and sharp. So this all ties together.
I would add, we have to really think about what lessons Xi Jinping has learned from the Russian conflict with Ukraine. I think he certainly knew about the invasion before it happened and talks with Putin and thought it would be a quick 1 or 2 weeks into Ukraine and it would be a fait accompli. And one would hope that he learned the lesson that that may not happen with any kind of conflict with Taiwan. Another angle to that is dealing with a dictatorship like Putin or Xi Jinping. Putin may just gave the order and the Russian military saluted and went in without really advising him that it could be a lot longer, or he just made some bad assumptions. And you wonder if Xi Jinping may make the same mistake. Oh, get ready by 2027 and okay, go forward. And the PLA is not really advising him that they've got their own concerns that this may not be realistic. So I think when it comes to deterrence, we really need to show not just the PLA, which I think may have some real doubts about their capability, even in the next few years, But it's got to be obvious to the leadership, to Xi Jinping himself, that this is not going to be a quick fait accompli.
Just to add a little more fuel to that fire, I think it's also important to note that they have no allies to turn to. They're starting to turn to each other, which I think is something that we're really starting to investigate more as researchers and analysts and practitioners over the last year. The idea that North Korea is shipping ammunition is a big deal. Also, Atlantic Council put out a very interesting research article on dual-purpose equipment going from China to Russia and showing up on the Ukrainian front, helping build defensive positions, which is slowing the progress of the Ukrainian army. These are really important things to keep track of between how leaderships make decisions and how you target leadership with the right narrative and make sure they receive the message. And then also beginning to understand what collusion between authoritarian leaders is and why it's happening and what that might mean for the future.
In terms of allies, we got the better hand there. They've only got a formal relationship with North Korea, and not sure what the quality of those arms coming out of North Korea are.
As the U.S. Department of Defense grows its China-focused think tank capability, as we now see in the Army War College's China Land Power Study Center, how do you think these organizations can contribute to improving the U.S.'s understanding of the strategic importance of Taiwan?
I think we need to step up the amount of interaction we have between our military colleges and Taiwan's. We need to urge our friends and allies to do the same. The national security strategy, the first mention of Taiwan in the latest NSSs, urges Europe to take a very active role in preserving peace in the Taiwan Straits. I know that they probably have been more reluctant to accept students and faculty interaction, let's say, between Taiwan officers and their own, but I think they need to step up those interactions. We need to do more. I know that Japan, they're not willing to say it outright, but they're right up there. And Taiwan is a very strategic issue for Japan's defense. And yet they've been very reluctant to have direct interaction between the Taiwan military and their own. So as a first step, I think we need to accept more Taiwan military students into our colleges. Right now, we have a few. They don't wear their uniform, and we keep it kind of quiet. But the fact is that they learn interoperability and other issues with our military, and they actually have a chance to interact with militaries of other countries like Japan, the Philippines, who actually consider Taiwan to be of vital or greater interest to them. I think having more trips out to Taiwan and inviting more Taiwan officers to come to our colleges and learn and build those relationships is a very important part of that.
From the research perspective, here in the Army, we're rather new to the think tank game. The Air University has the China Aerospace Studies Institute. The Naval War College has the China Maritime Studies Institute. National Defense University has a long-running China program. But the fact is, most of these organizations have traditionally focused on Chinese military capabilities, which remain vital to the study here. Ultimately, I think there needs to be a bit more of a refocus where there's an improved or enhanced research effort to understanding Taiwan's own military capabilities. And who better to do this than the DoD organizations already looking at China? A lot of them have the language capability already, but as mentioned, there is an improved relationship between the military staff colleges and defense universities. It gives a better chance to improve that understanding, including additional articles that can be published in a wide variety of periodicals. Ultimately, I think there's just a severe limit to how most people in the DoD and U.S. public really understand Taiwan, not only from the government perspective, but as mentioned, from the military perspective. So it's easy to say, hey, look, the Chinese would probably have a real hard time crossing the strait and landing on some real rocky shores. But understanding Taiwan's own military culture, its own strategy, I think would be worthwhile for the new generation to read up on, learn, and help guide future policymakers.
That's a great question. I think from the standpoint of what Josh has said with the center here standing up, we finally have the ability to start looking across all the domains from expertise areas that were sort of either functionally or by service oriented on. So you get a more complete picture as we research, do analysis, and support education. We're mostly an externally focused organization where we're looking for support, other folks work in the senior leader and practitioner level, as well as helping advise other think tanks and policymakers on what they should be looking at with more depth. I think those are all critically important things if you look at how the adversary intends to fight and how it intends to have its own way of doing business, is sort of day-to-day campaigning and trying to achieve their national objectives tied to what the U.S. military and the wider joint force and the wider interagency is supposed to do, and then tie that to our allies and partners in a similar fashion so that we can help them stiffen their own backbone. One of the things that I think is fascinating is if we go back to the question about what are we learning out of Ukraine. NATO is right adjacent to Ukraine, with Ukraine fully vested in a partnership for peace and perhaps becoming an ally at some point in time. the same thing has to be looked at for Taiwan. For example, what sort of research analysis should we be doing and sharing with the community of interest so that they begin to understand more of what the Taiwan military is about? And if war comes, how do you connect with them as fast as possible? Because the lead time and the geographic separations and being in an archipelagic environment create a completely different problem set that we don't have a NATO. We basically have our hub and spoke allies and partners that we're trying to make more look like a wheel over time or a network of allies and strategic partners. So I think how we work and explain how they have agency with Taiwan and having Taiwan understand the agency that they have to work together to ward off a crisis and be prepared for that crisis, I think is important.
I've dealt with Taiwan for a long time, and they've had a tradition of having think tanks, but they're mostly focused on international relations and promotion of democracy and things like that. They really need to be enhancing their military research. There's an opportunity there, I think, to encourage Taiwan war colleges and U.S. war colleges to work together to conduct research on the things you just mentioned. In my article, I actually did recommend not only that there be more interaction, but that Taiwan study places like Sweden and Israel, and this was published before the Gaza conflict just erupted, because they are on the front lines of conflict, and Ukraine has done a fantastic job in terms of learning how to build reserves and military resources in the event of a contingency. I think there needs to be a lot more research on their end on how to get the civil population involved into a possible conflict. Israel's always done a great job with that. I know Sweden has done a lot of work on civil defense because of their proximity to Russia. And of course, the Ukraine situation showed how it should be done.
Talking with some of my counterparts in Taiwan, they understand that. There's a growing political resolve to ensure that Taiwan can make its own decisions. As I think you point out in your article, they're upping the mobilization time back to 12 months. They're starting to institute reforms. They're upping their defense budget. And you're right, the ability to have a reserve that can be mobilized and fully supported and sustain itself is very critical and definitely a lesson learned. Probably worldwide. I think we have similar problems if we ever got into a large conflict. Some of this, we have to take the advice ourselves on what type of war are you preparing for so that you can actually maintain peace by deterrence. And I think that's front and center in the mind of the leadership in Taipei right now. The other thing from a military perspective is, are we entering a heightened time of potential crisis because you're going through a leadership transition in Taipei? And would the CCP choose to test that new leader after they take office? Would be something that we probably need to pay attention to.
That's a fantastic point. China's had a history of trying to influence not just the elections in Taiwan, but maybe our own over here. In the 90s, when Taiwan held its very first election, they shot missiles into Taiwan's straits as more or less in anger because they perceived the lead candidate, Lee Teng-hui, to be too pro-independence. Ever since then, they've tried to intimidate Taiwan voters into trying to choose a candidate that's a little closer to the way the Chinese see it. That's backfired. Every time they've tried to intimidate Taiwan voters, they come out and are quite defiant.
I guess a lot of these things are straight out of science military strategy, where they like to talk about, here's how you deter, let's fire off new weapons, let's do all kinds of scary stuff. I think it's an interesting topic. When we were out in Taiwan, a lot of people had different opinions about this one. But ultimately, I think they'll stay quiet for the time being, until at least the near term, until somebody decides to make another trip out there.
If they do, in fact, test the resolve of the new president, we really need to be thinking forward ourselves. What's the U.S. response? Because the Chinese are great at salami slicing, pushing the envelope, going over the median line with their fighter jets over and over again. And we don't want to escalate the situation. And yet we have to have a certain breaking point where we have to push back. And so we're going to have to give that a lot of thought. And maybe that's something that your new center can put some brain power to.
Do you have any concluding thoughts?
Just to close, it's been a great conversation. Hope people take some thoughts away from this and continue to help us understand strategy, implementation, areas of research in your expertise area that can support the way that the national security strategies of basically everyone in the free and open Indo-Pacific espouse. I think it's important to note the idea of the free and open Indo-Pacific wasn't a U.S. administration. It was actually President Abe in Japan that first proposed it. So the way we work with our allies and partners and the way we understand Taiwan and how we help Taiwan and how Taiwan helps themselves create that deterrence value, absolutely critical to maintaining the way of life that we put in place at the end of World War II, lifting hundreds of millions out of poverty over years, creating all these new economies, creating more individual freedom and a want and a desire for democracy. Those are all things that we have to work together to continue. And I'm glad to be part of the discussion. And really looking forward to the China Land Power Study Center getting after some of those questions.
I'm going to second all of that. It's great input. And I really think that, as I mentioned earlier, there needs to be an emphasis on understanding Taiwan a bit more. Ultimately, we are a DOD organization here, and I think it's worthwhile to understand Taiwan's military capacity and help improve that. Through strategic land power, I think everything that Colonel Butler just mentioned, when you get into building those partnerships and trying to deter any kind of future action, if you want to stop them from blockading, you make it so that your partners there have long-range precision weapons that can stop those types of blockades, or ensuring that the Straits of Malacca are open, not just through naval power, but through land power. There's a lot of ways we can go forward with this one, and I'm really excited to be here at the China Land Power Study Center to get after more of these strategic topics.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to this conversation. Every time we talk, it brings all sorts of new thoughts into my mind and new ways of looking at things, and I learn a lot from the interaction. I think you've got a great start to the China Land Power Study Center. I'm happy to help and interact in any way I can after this podcast. And I think if there is a testing of the new leadership, I think the inauguration's not until May, but love to have a follow-up discussion and see how things are going.
Listeners, you can find Dr. Balaki's articles at press.armywarcollege.edu/parameters. Thank you all for making time to speak with me today. This was a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of Conversations on Strategy and would like to hear more, you can find us on any major podcast platform.